So one of the things that you mentioned was throwing a little bit of echo chamber on the mix, right? And I thought when you might explain why, when you say using reverb at Capitol, it's a particularly awesome reverb that you have, not what everybody's got.
Well, Capitol Studios, we have, because we're an old studio, we still have our live echo chambers that were built, you know, when the studio was built. So we have 8 live echo chambers. They're about 30 feet underground under our parking lot. They're big pie-shaped rooms that have 2 speakers in them and 2 microphones. The story is that when they built the building in 56, if you wanted reverb, you had to make it. There was no... This is before plates and springs and all that kind of stuff, and certainly before the digital stuff. So if you wanted reverb, you had to make it. So every studio needed an echo chamber. And when they built Capitols, they decided to put them under the parking lot. So they actually put in 4 echo chambers down there. And that's what they used on, you know, when you hear the old Nat King Cole and the Sinatra records and Dean Martin and all that kind of stuff. That's the echo that they used. And then they realized they needed more. They didn't have enough. So... in 1969, they actually dug up the parking lot and added 4 more identical chambers. So there's 8 of them now. And there's nothing like it. It's natural echo. You know, we change the mics once in a while when they break, if a speaker component breaks. But other than that, we don't really go down there. They just exist as they exist. And there's a central patch bay in the hallway at Capitol, and we can patch in and out of them from any room in the building. We send it off an aux end and it goes into the chambers and out the speakers and bangs around down there, and the microphones pick it up, and then we bring the microphones back up to the console as the reverb returns, and that's the echo. If you don't like it, try another one.
Right. Or can you do sometimes just like change a microphone or change the speakers and move the speakers around in the space? Uh-huh. I mean, like, what are some of the decisions that you make about getting the right room? I mean, getting the right sound with the chamber when you're using it?
Well, we haven't made any decisions, because most of the speakers that are down there are still the original Altec Voice of the Theater speakers. We have played around with a few of them and changed the speakers. You know, we end up rolling off some top end a little bit on them just because it gets loud and bright down there.
You're rolling off the top of the return?
On the send of the speaker.
On the send of the speaker, okay.
And then once in a while, people will put an EQ in front of the send and tailor it a little bit more. And then we actually use fairly inexpensive Shure SM80 microphones in the chambers. Reason being, for a long time, and we finally figured out what the problem was, it was really kind of dank and musty down there. The microphones only lasted a year or two, and then the diaphragms would get corroded, and we would have to swap them out.
Are those small diaphragm condensers?
Yeah, they're small diaphragm condensers and Omni, actually, mics. And we tried more expensive mics, and it really didn't make that much of a sonic difference. You know, when you're changing out 16 microphones all the time, changing out $300 mics is a lot easier than changing out $1,500 mics. So now... last year, I guess, and we actually partnered with Universal Audio and made a plug-in of our chambers, of 4 of them. And when we did that, we started doing some research, and we actually found Art, our general manager, found the original blueprints for the chambers. The chambers were originally designed by Les Paul, actually. And I actually talked to Les about it one day, and he told me, oh yeah, I still have the drawings at my house and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of people say, oh, they can't prove that it was, but Les told me that he designed them. So I'm fine with that.
Nice. Right.
We found the original blueprints, and on the original blueprints, it actually gave us what microphones were originally used and where they were placed. So one of the things when we decided to do this plugin, we wanted to have some options for the plugin, just so there were some parameters, you know. So we decided that we would do 4 of the chambers, and we would do 4 microphone sets for each chamber. So when you pull up a preset, what shows up as the default for each chamber is what's in there now, which are the SM80s. And we just left them where they are in the room, and that's the way, if you come to Capitol, that's the way they are. But then we also went back, because we still have the old Altec mics that were in the chambers originally, we actually went and placed those mics according to the blueprints where they were originally designed to be placed. And then we did a couple others just for fun. After a few months, we got it. I mean, I've put the two up next to each other and you really can't tell the difference between the plugin and the live chamber.
So one of the things that I remember learning about using a plate reverb was using pre-delay. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, we use pre-delay a lot. You know, pre-delay, it's a great way to separate the reverb from the original source, whatever that may be. So yeah, I mess with pre-delays quite a bit. Sometimes if I'm mixing something that's more of a pop thing, I'll time the delays to the song. The same way as you would time a delay on a vocal, I'll time the pre-delays. But yeah, I'll always kind of separate. I want to separate the sound a little bit. Ironically, the one thing we don't pre-delay a lot, or at least me, is the chamber. The chambers are pretty long to begin with. And because they're so natural and great sounding, we actually don't pre-delay the chambers all that much. But almost every other reverb we use will have some kind of pre-delay on it, anywhere from 20 milliseconds to, you know, a vocal may have 90, 100, 120 millisecond pre-delay on it.
The 20 millisecond tape delay or whatever it is will actually sort of has this effect of separating and clearing up the vocal so you hear the reverb afterwards. But so you use it on some of the other things sometimes, but just not on the chambers?
Sometimes we'll do it. It's not that it sounds bad when you do it. It just doesn't always seem necessary. Or it's a way to, you know, it's a way to keep, like on a vocal, it's a way to have the reverb on the vocal, which is very pleasing, but to push it away from the vocal, if that makes sense. So you get the presence of the vocal and then the reverb comes. You know, I've used it as an effect instead of having a delay on something where I want to repeat, I may put a short reverb with a really long pre-delay.
So Steve, let's segue for a minute and let me see if I can get you to talk a little bit about some of your favorite ways to record and mix drums in the studio. So what are some of the ways that miking up a jazz kit or a rock kit can be different from each other?
Yeah, it's actually not that much different. The initial setup is, I might change microphones out a little bit, but not much. Usually just the overhead mics. If I'm doing something more like a rock session, I'm probably trying to get more of an image of the kit out of the overheads because he's going to be hitting harder. So I'm going to be hearing the toms and the snare and all that kind of stuff prominently in the overhead mics. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be more conscious of where the snare ends up in the image and stuff like that. If I'm doing a jazz kit, the overhead mics end up being more like cymbal mics. So I get the detail of the cymbals and I lean on the close mics a little bit more. But the actual setup isn't that much different. If it's a rock kit, you know, for the bass drum, I'll probably put a D12 or a D12 VR, you know, inside the hole. It may not go very deep into the drum, depending on the sound I want. If I need more clicky from the bass drum, I'll shove the mic in a little farther. A rock kit, I'll use like a sub kick, you know, an NS10 woofer kind of thing. Maybe a FET 47 outside if I need it. Snare, on the top of the snare, I like small diaphragm condensers. I'll use an AKG 452, or I have a couple of Mojave MA100s, which unfortunately they don't make anymore, but they're small diaphragm tube mics and they can take a snare, which is great. I usually use 414s on the toms if I can get them. One mic called the 350 that works really great. Something on the hi-hat, something small diaphragm. Well, sometimes I'll use a ribbon mic on the hi-hat, a little Beyer 160. And then for overheads, a number of different things. If rock drums, I'll tend to use a large diaphragm condenser, a U67s or C12s or C12As, something like that. And then it's just balance to taste. I usually start with the overheads, push up the overhead mics, get them sounding pretty good, and then just kind of fill in the blanks with the close mics.
One of the things that I've been really trying to figure out more of when I'm recording rock drums is I got a little tired of using the same mic inside the kick drum where it really had like almost too much beater attack. And I've been looking for ways to get more of like the pillowy kick drum. You talked about using the sub kick. So for you, like what are some of the ways that you can record the drum differently on a kick, for example, to decide whether it's going to be real punchy or whether it's going to be a little bit pillowier and softer sound?
As always, it starts with the drum and the drummer. The D112 has a little more click built into the mic, just the curve of the microphone. So that's why, yeah, I used the D112 for a long time, but then I kind of got away from that because I was getting too much of the clicky sound. So I went to the D12. And they're hard to find, but the D12 VR actually sounds very good. A tip about the D12 VR, if you engage the Phantom Power, it becomes active and there's some active filters on it. Don't use those. Use it as a dynamic mic. Get it away from the beater. Sometimes, again, that mic may not be very far inside of the hole. Maybe only half the mic might be in the hole. And then, again, I'll use the sub kick, so the little NS10 woofer trick. And I use that so I don't have to EQ, so I don't have to like add bottom end to it. I just bring that up. I mean, you have to get the levels right. You'll need pads and stuff like that. I might filter that mic. I might, you know, take the top end off, you know, down to even like 1K or below. And I'll use that instead of an EQ. And sometimes I'll even sum them to the same track, you know, just record them as one kick drum. But yeah, it's moving that mic around. If you have an assistant or a friend or somebody, you know, give them a set of earplugs and send them out there and, you know, start moving that mic around and see where in the drum is the sweet spot for what you're looking for. You know, if you're doing a faster tempo song, you might need more click on the kick drum to get it to pop out. If it's a slower ballady type thing, you can pull those mics back a little bit and get more of the tone of the drum. You know, add one outside. Sometimes you have to, you know, put a mic on the outside and maybe cover the kick drum and the mic with a blanket, that kind of thing, or the old drum tunnel trick. Sometimes it's just another mic outside the kit. You know, I might put a mic, you know, a couple feet outside the kick.
How about compression? How often do you use, you know, and where and when do you use compression when you're recording the drum kit or when you're mixing it and find it useful to get a better drum sound?
You know, with compression on drums, I actually don't compress drums all that much. But like, you know, especially nowadays, there's that, you know, that modern drum sound has like some, it's kind of heavy compression. My theory is I might compress one or two mics pretty heavily to get that sound, but not everything. Like I might have, like I said, a mic outside the kit a couple feet and I'll hit that one pretty hard, or a mic directly over the top, like a mono overhead, and I'll squash the piss out of that sound, but still have the open drums to deal with. Or sometimes a little bit of parallel compression. I don't use a ton of parallel compression, but for that kind of effect, I will.
Now, do you ever use the trick where you're like taking a mic and you put it right in between the kick and the snare and compress that?
Yeah, I'll put it right in between them usually. And kind of get it as low as I can without getting in the drummer's way. Sometimes that's, you know, I've done it with a 57. It works great. Sometimes a ribbon mic, a Royer, or an old RCA 77, something like that. And then I might take a little bit more time and tailor a little bit, depending on what compressors I have available to me, you know, a Fairchild or 1176, something like that, and kind of mess with the attack and the release to get the pop that I'm looking for, but, you know, also the sustain out of it.
Let's jump over to bass. Like, what are some things that you like to do on every session for recording bass and getting a great bass sound, whether it's upright or electric bass?
Electric bass, pretty easy. I have a good tube DI is always helpful. If they have an amp, I'll stick a mic in front of the amp, a 47 FET. I like large diaphragm condensers for that. And then I'll blend the two, make sure they're in phase. That's where, you know, I'll check polarity on that kind of stuff and check phase. I'll actually flip the phase and make sure that they're in phase.
Right, lining up the DI with the mic.
Exactly. And that's a spot where a lot of times you'll get some wonkiness. But you may have to move the mic around a little bit to get it to really... And that's where I like the... When you flip the phase, if you can get all the bottom end to go away, you know you're in that your phase is really solid. So.
Right, right. Do you also do like time delays between the DI and the microphone to try and like line stuff up when you're tracking and get them in phase that way? Is that part of the process?
I try to avoid it as much as I can. If that happens, it usually happens in the mixing stage. If something is very out time-wise, but I'll try to get it at the recording. Yeah, I'll move the mic around. To see, you know, you can zoom in and look at the waveforms so you can see which one is out.
Right. And usually it's the amp, the mic is later than the DI.
It
right?
usually is. But I probably won't address that in the recording stage. I would probably address that in the mixing stage.
Because it makes more sense. Like if you can get it right at the tracking, just get it to sound right at that.
Exactly.
That
and again, always the best thing is to hire a great bass player. who has good sounding instruments.
Right, totally.
You know, that's, I always say, you know, how do you get a great bass sound? You hire Lee Sklar, who's one of the best bass players around. So, and then now acoustic bass is a totally different thing. At this stage of the game, both of us do kind of the same thing because I learned it from him. We use a pair of M149s and one of the mics goes down. So if you're looking at the bass and the bass player, it would go to the right side in front of the F hole on the bass on the right side. And then the second mic would go to the left side of the bass player and kind of up where the neck and the bass meet. So you get some of the finger sound out of that. And then, you know, you set the gain on those two mics so they're kind of equal. And then we use them in mono. It's not a stereo thing. So they'll both come up the middle. But that mic in that position gives us a pretty great bass sound. M149s I know are really expensive, but there's, you know, two large diaphragm condensers. Yeah, the 149s are great because they have a really great top end. One thing about bass that a lot of people think of bass as low end, and it is, but there's an awful lot of information in the top end of a bass. So don't forget about it. It shouldn't be a boomy thing. It should live full frequency. And a lot of what I find people miss in acoustic bass is they try to add all this low end to it. And it just, that's not what it wants to do. There's actually more information in the upper register that is the presence and the actual note.
So it's almost a little bit backwards where you talked about it, where it's like the mic that's down getting the lows is actually closer to the high strings on the bass, and the mic that's getting the highs is closer to the low strings on the bass, but it all balances out somehow.
Yes. So backwards, the low string goes near the high, the low mic goes near the high strings, and the high mic goes near the low strings. And it's kind of, if you look at the bass, it's kind of directly above the F hole, where the, so, but at the height where the neck and the body of the bass meet. So they're kind of equidistant apart, the mic, you know.
And do you try and have them be sort of the same distance from the body of the bass as well?
Yes, as much as you can, because that's where you're going to get the phase thing.
And then do you also find that it's valuable to have a good DI on the bass?
Not usually. We, you know, we're lucky we get to work with great bass players. If it's a live situation, then I'll probably definitely take a DI if I can. Sometimes if I'm a little iffy about the bass player and or the sound of the bass, I may take that DI, get a level and make sure it sounds okay, and then not listen to it, but have it in my back pocket later if I need it. If you need to EQ it to get a little, you know, they say, oh, we need a little bit more finger. It didn't come out and I can't really hear the attack of the notes. Sometimes you can EQ that DI and slide it up in there. And it can be very useful if you don't have a great bass player.
Right. And, you know, sometimes it's the smarter thing if you've got plenty of inputs with take an extra mic just in case. So you've got it kind of as a safety, even if you don't really think you're going to be using it.
I was going to say, I'll do that sometimes with stuff like a ride cymbal mic. Like I might put a mic on the ride cymbal and then not use it, but I'll have it later if I need it. Sometimes I'll throw extra mics up just in case, but with no intention of using them unless I have a problem.
Awesome. What about guitars? Let's talk guitars for a minute. How do you like to record an acoustic guitar, for example, on a session? What are some good ways to get a great acoustic sound?
Acoustic guitars, again, it depends on what the guitar is supposed to be doing. If it's a solo guitar, if it's the main finger picking style, or, you know, is it just a rhythm guitar? So yeah, I'll use that stereo technique we talked about before. If not, a small diaphragm condenser in front of the guitar, you know, kind of around the 14th fret or wherever that is, you know, find the spot. A good tip is if you got a pair of headphones, sometimes I'll have the guitar player play and I'll put the mic in the headphones and I'll put on the headphones and kind of move the mic around till it sounds the way I want it to sound. If it's a more percussive-y kind of guitar, you know, I'm not opposed to a good old 57 or an SM7. Just doing, especially like in a big band where it's, you know, we call the Freddie Green, where he's just chunking along like a percussion instrument. Right. I'll use a 57 on that all the time. One other thing I've learned about acoustic guitars, because, you know, there's a great range of quality of the actual guitars themselves. And, mm-hmm. you know, I ran into a thing one time. We were recording a student. She was a girl who was, you know, a teenager who had kind of won a contest to come in and do something. And and she really liked her guitar. And we had a couple of really nice guitars for her to play, but she just wasn't used to them. And it wasn't, when she played them, they sounded great, but it really wasn't working. So we let her play her guitar, which didn't sound that great. And we had all these great mics set up, and the guitar just didn't sound right. It was, I mean, she was playing better, but the guitar didn't sound right. And I changed, you know, I had a 67 and a C12 and a 451. And I went through like three or four mics, and finally I ran out there and I put a 57 on it, and it sounded great.
Nice.
And I kind of came to the conclusion, you know, if you have a really crappy sounding instrument and you put a really great mic on it, you have a really great recording of a crappy sounding instrument.
Yeah.
So sometimes a cheap mic, you know, crappy mic, crappy guitar. So don't be afraid to do stuff like that.
Now, do you sometimes use like a 57 plus another mic where you can use the blending of the microphones to actually get the EQ you want on the guitar?
Absolutely. If it's just going to be, you know, a doubled strummy rhythm guitar part, then a nice bright mic will do that. Anything I can do to avoid an EQ is kind of a good tip also. Anytime you start adding equipment, plugins, that kind of stuff, you're compromising something. You might be making something better, but you're compromising something else. So anytime I can avoid that, I do. Not that I don't use EQs and plugins and stuff. If I need it, I'll go to it. But I try to avoid it as much as I possibly can.
Okay. How about piano? What are some great ways to record piano on a session?
Piano's tough because there's a million different recording techniques for piano. I typically, again, we'll go to the large diaphragm condensers, and I kind of stick them right over the hammers, maybe a foot or so above the strings. But
we're talking about like a grand piano, right?
A grand piano, yeah. The lid will be on the high stick if it's up all the way. And I'll get the one over the low mic kind of as high as I can get it without banging into the lid and match the two of them. And that's for something where it's going to live in a track, whether it's a pop song or a rock song or a, you know, a jazz. But if it's living inside of other instruments, that works great. I tend to get enough presence on it and a nice stereo image and that kind of stuff. If it's more of a solo piano piece, then I might put the mics just outside the piano, and I'll aim one kind of at the high strings and then one kind of down, maybe halfway down the piano, aimed more at the low strings. And then I can get a little more air around the piano and feel the space that it's being played in a little bit more. And I don't have to worry about other instruments leaking into it and stuff like that. If you have other instruments in the room, then you got to stick the mics in there, and you may have to cover it with blankets and stuff like that.
Now, what about recording grand piano and trying to get a stereo sound where you've really got something that works from the low notes to the high notes as a stereo image? What are some of the things that you listen for to know if you need to move the mics?
So I'll be listening. If I hear, it's kind of like a hole in the middle. Like if when the piano player goes from low to high or high to low, there's kind of a dip in the middle in volume, then your mics are probably too wide or too narrow of a pattern on the microphones, in which case you're gonna have to go out and make some adjustments. Maybe move them closer together so that you don't have that. You know, if you're missing notes on the piano, or sections of the piano, or if one section is, you know, if when he hits the piano, the notes that are right below your microphone, it really jumps out, then you may have to move the mics, you know, move them up or back or find a different spot.
Okay, so you're spacing your mics out to try and get the right spacing on them. What about the direction they're pointed at? I mean, are these mics, do they need to be pivoted out kind of like a XY would or like an ORTF? And angled away from each other, or are they just straight down?
I tend to keep them facing down because you figure my starting position, the mics are probably 3 feet apart inside the piano. So, I mean, you're talking about moving them, you know, 6-8 inches either direction probably. The other thing would be, you know, we can go back to our stereo mic, something like the C24 or the Vanguard mic, and just put them at a 90 degree angle, the mics, two cardioids, and stick that right over the middle of the piano, and you'll probably get a really great piano sound. I mean, I've done it with C24s a lot. I never actually tried the Vanguard in the piano, but I'm sure it would be great. And there you have, again, I'll sometimes do that if I'm in like a pop song or a rock song where I think there's a possibility that that piano may end up in mono, which is not unusual. You know, if I got a lot of guitars and stuff, I may just stick that piano in mono and put it on the left or something like that. Because you have that stereo mic, it's all the phase is going to be perfect. It's going to collapse the mono beautifully.
Steve, you've had a lot of opportunity to work with some pretty incredible artists and producers in the studio, one of whom is Burt Bacharach, which is awesome. Tell us a story about, you know, working with Burt. What was it like to work with Burt Bacharach?
For the most part, kind of the bigger the star, the easier they are to get along with. And they're usually pretty cool people. You know, they got nothing to prove, but except what they're doing right then, you know?
That's cool. What advice would you go back and give yourself if you could?
I mean, I kind of did it the way I thought I was going to do it. So pay attention a little bit more, maybe less talking, more listening kind of thing. Don't pigeonhole yourself into one thing. I realized, and I didn't realize it till I was at Capitol. You get into this business thinking you're going to do something. You know, I mean, I figured I was going to be making rock records, you know, my whole career, and, you know, the Rolling Stones were going to call me and that was what I was going to do. And now, you know, it's really fun. I get to do those kind of records, but I also get to make jazz records, which I didn't know I liked doing. And I get big band records, which I didn't know I liked doing. And, you know, radio shows, which I didn't know I liked doing, and all that kind of stuff. So there's so many jobs in audio out there that, you know, the job that you're going to end up in that you're really good at, you may not even know exists. You know, you may be the next greatest dialogue editor for films, and you don't even know that that job is there. So have an open mind as to what's out there in audio. And it's not all about making records. Making records is actually a very little part of the audio business. It might be the fun part, but it's very little. And I find myself doing it less and less, but I'm still working and I'm still having a good time doing other stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us here on Recording Studio Rockstars.
It was my pleasure. It's been fun.
Let the rock stars know, how could they find you online? Where should they go if they need to call you up to make their very next hit record?
Best way is my website, stevegenowick.com. There's all kinds of stuff up there that probably needs to be updated. I also have a Facebook page, Steve Genowick Recording Engineer is my kind of business page. I have a personal Facebook page, but honestly, if I don't know you, I'm probably not going to accept that friend request. And then, you know, I'm around. I'm not that hard to find. So
awesome, Steve. Well, thank you again. It's just a real honor to have you here on the show with us. And thank you so much for taking, you know, a couple of hours out of your day to come do this interview with us. It's pretty remarkable, and it's very generous of you.